The Campaign for Clean Air has just passed a report on air pollution, and we have in the studio Francis Kelly of the CCA, who's going to tell us something about the dangers we face from air pollutants.
Hello.
Let's start with sulfur dioxide, which causes acid rain. I thought the government was doing something about that.
Well, they are, but slowly. Sulfur dioxide emissions from power stations are still going on, and the resulting acid rain is still killing off fishes and plant life in lakes and destroying the forests. And we in Britain are among the worst victims when it comes to this kind of pollution.
What are the other pollutants?
Carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide. Carbon monoxide, which is mostly produced by motor vehicles, can, even in small doses, cause sickness and a slowing of the reflexes, and there is strong evidence to show that it has an effect on the growth of children.
Oh, and carbon dioxide?
Well, in a way, this is the least dangerous of the pollutants we've mentioned, but in the longer term, it may be the most damaging.
Why?
There is clear evidence that the buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is the main cause of the greenhouse effect. This will have dreadful results, like the melting of the polar ice caps and subsequent flooding of low-lying areas.
So what you're saying is that the increased amounts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is making it warmer?
Yes, that's right, and the results will be disastrous.
And what should we be doing about this?
Frankly, the government has got to impose far stricter controls on these emissions and make laws to deal with the problem.
Francis Kelly, thank you very much.
Thank you.
After the news, we hope to be talking to the Minister of the Environment, Patrick Hillard.
You now have 50 seconds to check your answers to questions 6 through 10. Now you will hear the recording again.
The Campaign for Clean Air has just passed a report on air pollution, and we have in the studio Francis Kelly of the CCA, who's going to tell us something about the dangers we face from air pollutants.
Hello.
Let's start with sulfur dioxide, which causes acid rain. I thought the government was doing something about that.
Well, they are, but slowly. Sulfur dioxide emissions from power stations are still going on, and the resulting acid rain is still killing off fishes and plant life in lakes and destroying the forests. And we in Britain are among the worst victims when it comes to this kind of pollution.
What are the other pollutants?
Carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide. Carbon monoxide, which is mostly produced by motor vehicles, can, even in small doses, cause sickness and a slowing of the reflexes, and there is strong evidence to show that it has an effect on the growth of children.
Oh, and carbon dioxide?
Well, in a way, this is the least dangerous of the pollutants we've mentioned, but in the longer term, it may be the most damaging.
Why?
There is clear evidence that the buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is the main cause of the greenhouse effect. This will have dreadful results, like the melting of the polar ice caps and subsequent flooding of low-lying areas.
So what you're saying is that the increased amounts of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is making it warmer?
Yes, that's right, and the results will be disastrous.
And what should we be doing about this?
Frankly, the government has got to impose far stricter controls on these emissions and make laws to deal with the problem.
Francis Kelly, thank you very much.
Thank you.
After the news, we hope to be talking to the Minister of the Environment, Patrick Hillard.
You now have 30 seconds to check your answers to questions 6 through 10. This is the end of Part B.
Part C, directions. You will hear three pieces of recorded materials. Before listening to each one, you will have time to read the questions related to it. While listening, answer each question by choosing A, B, C, or D. After listening, you will have time to check your answers. You will hear each piece once only. Questions 11 to 13 are based on the following interview. You now have 15 seconds to read questions 11 to 13.
Could you tell me a bit about why you wanted to be a doctor and how you first got into the medical profession?
Well, you've asked a rather strange person a pretty standard question. I happened to be doing languages for my A-level at school, and I decided that I didn't think there was a great deal of future in the study of languages. So I decided that I'd change over to some scientific subject that I felt might be useful. and after a great deal of difficulty, got accepted to the medical school. Found it very difficult to get going, but eventually succeeded and perfectly happy. Certainly found the ability at least to appreciate other forms of things than purely basic science has been very helpful.
So you mean eventually you went into a medical school or university without any A-levels in scientific subjects?
That's right. The first morning, the lecturer wrote up some chemical formula on the board, which was the first chemistry lecture I had ever been to. As far as I was concerned, she might have been putting it up in Egyptian hieroglyphics. It didn't mean a thing. So that was a long time ago.
So you had a lot of sort of personal individual work to do to catch up with everyone else then?
Yes, it was very hard. But the university I was at, which was Sheffield, had a kind of special class for what you might call lame ducks such as myself. And there was a retired watchmaker. There was a chemist. There was a dentist. There were a couple of nurses. People who had come to do medicine in later life, having taken up other things. So I think they looked after themselves pretty well. And most of us in the end managed to get through.
And you eventually qualified?
Yes. When I qualified in Sheffield way back in 1960, I was then actually so interested in the general aspects of medicine that I joined a special practice at the University of Manchester that was teaching general practice. And I was there for 4 years. Thoroughly enjoyed it. It was teaching medical students and being involved very closely with the academic side of medical practice. And from then on, went on to student health service work back in my former University of Sheffield, and then came down here to Reading 12 years ago. You now have 30 minutes to check your answers to questions 11 to 13.
Questions 14 through 16 are based on the following talk about paper. You now have 15 seconds to read questions 14 through 16. The Chinese have been making paper for 2,000 years. Paper was one of the most important inventions in the whole of Chinese history. As a result of this invention, much is known about Chinese history because records were kept on paper. However, in other parts of the world, much of the history over hundreds of years is completely unknown. As there was no paper in these countries, no records were kept. It is believed that before writing was developed, people in China used to keep records by putting a number of stones together. As soon as writing was developed, people carved words on animal bones. Later, words were carved on metal pots. Examples of these have been found from the 16th to the 3rd centuries BC. Between the 2nd and the 5th centuries AD, people wrote on pieces of bamboo or wood, and these were tied together to form a book. Although these were much more useful than the metal pots, they were still difficult to read and were very heavy to carry. At the same time, another kind of paper was developed, made from silk. Some silk books that have been found are over 2,140 years old. It was easy to write and draw on silk. The problem was that it was too valuable for everyday use. Because it was so expensive, people developed a kind of paper made from the fibers of plants. They used fishing nets, the outside of trees, pieces of old clothes, and so on. These things were put in water for a few hours and then beaten again and again. The fibers joined together and were beaten flat and then dried in a sheet. This kind of paper was as soft and light as silk, but much less expensive. By the 1st century, the making of paper in some parts of China had been well developed and had become common. After a time, the invention reached other countries. In the 8th century, a paper-making factory was set up in the Middle East, from which paper was sent all over Europe. Spain started making paper in 1150. And Russia started in 1567. Paper has been made in America. You now have 30 minutes to check your answers to questions 14 through 16.
Questions 17 through 20 are based on the following part of radio program, in which two voices exchange their opinions on television as an advertising channel and tobacco as a business. You now have 20 seconds to read questions 17 through 20. I wonder if we could turn to another issue that is worrying television companies, and that is the subject of advertising revenue. Look at the example of the ban against tobacco commercials. As you know,
as part of a general health campaign, Many countries banned all cigarette advertising on television some years ago. But now the ban appears to be spreading to many more countries and...
Well, it may be to the advantage of the health of the viewers, but it's obviously to the disadvantage of the financial health of the tobacco firms.
Not necessarily. In most cases, the tobacco companies have simply moved their ads from the airwaves to the printed media, to the delight of publishers, at the same time saving themselves money, as print has the advantage of being much cheaper than airtime. Also, they've branched out into yet more sports and cultural sponsorship, which has the added advantage of giving cigarettes a more positive appeal.
Oh, yes? Could you be more specific?
A good illustration of that is, I read somewhere that Pavarotti had given opera performances as special cultural promotions funded by a cigarette manufacturer.
Well, I think that shows fine marketing sense, and it helps expensive events. That allows more cultural performances to be staged, and it gives more people the opportunity to watch first-class performances. Most people can't usually afford that sort of entertainment because the tickets are so expensive. Sponsorship subsidies mean that prices for the general public are much lower.
But what about the television stations? Apparently, the withdrawal of cigarette advertising income is having a fairly dramatic effect on their finances and, therefore, on their future.
Well, there are other advertisers. Surely it's not difficult for the TV companies to attract other customers who will pay for expensive airtime.
I'm not so sure. The tobacco firms are ready to pay big money for airing their commercials, especially at prime viewing time. They have huge advertising budgets, more than many other types of manufacturers, especially those producing non-luxury items.
And it shouldn't be forgotten that in many countries, people might be able to afford the luxury of a pack of cigarettes, whereas they cannot afford other, more expensive luxury goods. So it could be difficult to replace the loss of revenue from cigarette advertising with ads from other wealthy manufacturers or retailers.
Oh, in my opinion, the TV people...
The TV people have had it too easy, charging enormous fees for airtime and expecting manufacturers to shut up and pay up because of the relatively limited access to broadcasting. In most countries, you know, there are only one or two TV channels, and so a near monopoly situation there. Now, maybe they'll realize they have to earn their money like everyone else in the business world.
But is television a business, like cigarettes?
Well, I'm sorry. We have to stop there. That's all we have time for today. You now have 40 seconds to check your answers to questions 17 through 20. That is the end of Part C. You now have 5 minutes to transfer all your answers from your test booklet to answer sheet 1.
Section 1,
Listening Comprehension. Directions. This section is designed to test your ability to understand spoken English. You will hear a selection of recorded materials, and you must answer the questions that accompany them. There are 3 parts in this section, Part A, Part B, and Part C. Remember, while you are doing the test, you should first put down your answers in your test booklet. At the end of the listening comprehension section, you will have 5 minutes to transfer all your answers from your test booklet to answer sheet 1. Now look at Part A in your test booklet. Part A, Directions. For questions 1 to 5, you will hear a talk about Boston Museum of Fine Arts. While you listen, fill out the table with the information you have heard. Some of the information has been given to you in the table. Write only one word or number in each numbered box. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 25 seconds to read the table below.
Boston Museum of Fine Arts is a privately funded museum of fine arts. It was founded in 1870 and opened to the public in 1876. Originally housed in Copley Square, the museum moved in 1909 to its current location in another district in Boston. The building was designed by American architect Guy Lowell and features a grand dome with ceiling paintings by American painter John Singer Sargent. The most recent addition to the building is its West Wing, designed by a Chinese-American architect and completed in 1981. The museum is divided into 9 departments, including classical, ancient Egyptian, decorative arts and sculpture, paintings, contemporary, and the most remarkable one, textiles. The collections range from ancient history to the present and include such pieces as the Silver Liberty Bowl, portraits of George Washington and Martha Washington, painted by Gilbert Charles Stuart, and a number of works by French painter Claude Monet. The gallery's exhibition space is 19,137 square meters. About 800,000 people visit the museum each year. In addition to its galleries, collections, and traveling exhibitions, the museum provides programs that include classes, lectures, concerts, and films for adults, children, and families.
You now have 30 seconds to check your answers to questions 1 to 5. Now you will hear the recording again.
Boston Museum of Fine Arts is a privately funded museum of fine arts. It was founded in 1870 and opened to the public in 1876. Originally housed in Copley Square, the museum moved in 1909 to its current location in another district in Boston. The building was designed by American architect Guy Lowell and features a grand dome with ceiling paintings by American painter John Singer Sargent. The most recent addition to the building is its West Wing, designed by a Chinese-American architect and completed in 1981. The museum is divided into 9 departments, including classical, ancient Egyptian, decorative arts and sculpture, paintings, contemporary, and the most remarkable one, textiles. The collections range from ancient history to the present and include such pieces as the Silver Liberty Bowl, portraits of George Washington and Martha Washington, painted by Gilbert Charles Stuart, and a number of works by French painter Claude Monet. The gallery's exhibition space is 19,137 square meters. About 800,000 people visit the museum each year. In addition to its galleries, collections, and traveling exhibitions, the museum provides programs that include classes, lectures, concerts, and films for adults, children, and families.
You now have another 20 seconds to check your answers to questions 1 to 5. That is the end of Part A.
Part B. Directions. For questions 6 to 10, you will hear an interview with an expert on marriage problems. While you listen, complete the sentences or answer the questions. Use not more than 3 words for each answer. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 25 seconds to read the sentences and questions below.
When a couple runs into marriage problems, where should they turn?
The primary source of help should be the couple themselves. The last book I wrote, Four Weekends to an Ideal Marriage, describes how people can strengthen communication by setting aside a special time or place to meet and discuss their relationship. If they can't communicate verbally, they might at least write down a list of things that they feel have gone wrong in the marriage. The idea is to discuss these matters constructively, not to be vicious in the criticism. Some church groups have been very successful with marriage encounter weekends that help couples with this process.
What if couples can't work things out for themselves?
If people feel so bitter that they can't even talk with each other, they should consider very seriously a qualified psychologist. And I stress qualified, because there are a lot of unqualified people out there who can make things worse. The best approach, I believe, is to ask your family physician. If you were having some family problems or marriage problems, who would you seek out? In the main, priests, despite good intentions, are not successful in counseling troubled couples, except for those who have had special training in the behavioral sciences. If those two approaches don't work, then maybe the only solution is a divorce. This is particularly true if one of the parties simply refuses to work toward repairing the marriage, or, having gone through counseling, does not want to implement the ideas suggested.
How useful are trial separations?
There is value only if during the course of the separation, the parties are actively doing something to come close together and to find solutions to their problems. Merely relying on the old notion that absence will make the heart grow fonder never works.
You now have 50 seconds to check your answers to questions 6 to 10.
Now you will hear the recording again.
When a couple runs into marriage problems, where should they turn?
The primary source of help should be the couple themselves. The last book I wrote, Four Weekends to an Ideal Marriage, describes how people can strengthen communication by setting aside a special time or place to meet and discuss their relationship. If they can't communicate verbally, they might at least write down a list of things that they feel have gone wrong in the marriage. The idea is to discuss these matters constructively, not to be vicious in the criticism. Some church groups have been very successful with marriage encounter weekends that help couples with this process.
What if couples can't work things out for themselves?
If people feel so bitter that they can't even talk with each other, they should consider very seriously a qualified psychologist. And I stress qualified, because there are a lot of unqualified people out there who can make things worse. The best approach, I believe, is to ask your family physician. If you were having some family problems or marriage problems, who would you seek out? In the main, priests, despite good intentions, are not successful in counseling troubled couples, except for those who have had special training in the behavioral sciences. If those two approaches don't work, then maybe the only solution is a divorce. This is particularly true if one of the parties simply refuses to work toward repairing the marriage, or, having gone through counseling, does not want to implement the ideas suggested.
How useful are trial separations?
There is value only if during the course of the separation, the parties are actively doing something to come close together and to find solutions to their problems. Merely relying on the old notion that absence will make the heart grow fonder never works.
You now have another 30 seconds to check your answers to questions 6 to 10. That is the end of Part B. Part C, Directions. You will hear three pieces of recorded material. Before listening to each one, you will have time to read the questions related to it. While listening, answer each question by choosing A, B, C, or D. After listening, you will have time to check your answers. You will hear each piece once only. Questions 11 to 13 are based on the following talk about napping. You now have 15 seconds to read questions 11 to 13.
If you feel tired all the time, you don't necessarily need to go to bed earlier. The solution could be as simple as taking a 5-minute afternoon nap. Children under 5 have an abundance of energy, and one of the reasons is because they nap once or twice a day. Many sleep experts think we're programmed to take a nap during the day, and getting back into this habit can be a solution for those who feel tired all the time. Professor Chris Idzikowski of the Sleep Advisory and Assessment Center thinks that one can feel refreshed after just 5 minutes sleep, and research has shown that concentration and attention are improved after even a short nap. Sleep is genetically programmed in babies, and it's only as we get older that we learn to sleep for about 8 hours a night, and not at all during the day. But most research suggests that we're not physically designed to sleep for one long, single block. Before the working day became 9 to 5, all Western sleep patterns were more broken up. Research has shown that in the Middle Ages, people's sleep quite often occurred in three distinct parts: a nap in the afternoon, an early evening nap, and another longer sleep until dawn. So, if you do find yourself feeling sleepy through the day, don't feel you're being lazy by giving in to sleep and having a nap. Your increased energy and alertness will make the rest of your day extra productive.
You now have 30 seconds to check your answers to questions 11 to 13.
Questions 14 to 16 are based on the following interview with Sherman Alexie, an American Indian poet. You now have 15 seconds to read questions 14 to 16.
Good morning, Dr. Sherman Alexie. Let's talk about your life. Where you come from?
I come from the Rez, an Indian reservation. I grew up there, lived there until 18. I lived on and off the reservation for the next 6 or 7 years during college. I lived there after I graduated. Worked at a high school exchange program. I thought I'd do that kind of job to support my writing. Day jobs that require no emotional investment beyond 8 hours a day where I wouldn't need to bring work home. I didn't want to be part of management or anybody important had a job. I wanted to be completely replaceable. That's what I thought I would be doing for most of my life, and writing. Then I got a grant, and my first book got a front page review in the New York Times Book Review.
When did writing enter your life?
Books have always been in my life. My dad loved books, and most of what he read were westerns, spy novels, mysteries. I grew up loving books, copying my father's love for books. But nobody ever showed me a book written by an Indian. Not even one piece of a poem, nothing. At that time, I was going to be a physician. I loved math and science. I got to college, couldn't handle physiology, and was looking around for options, and took a poetry writing class for fun.
Poetry was your way in?
Yes, that's where I started. I took the class, and honestly, I just thought it would be an easy grade. But I completely underestimated poetry and what it would do to me, and the realm of possibility for it. I took the class and was hooked about 10 minutes after reading my first contemporary poem.
You now have 30 seconds to check your answers to questions 14 to 16.
Questions 17 to 20 are based on the following talk about public speaking. You now have 20 seconds to read questions 17 to 20.
In public speaking, the watchword is preparation. Most of us tend to put things off, at least occasionally. It's so easy to put things off, especially those things we do not look forward to doing. So if a speaking engagement is several weeks off, we may feel that we still have plenty of time. But as the day draws closer, we begin to panic. Don't let this happen to you. Start preparing as soon as you are given or accept the speaking assignment. You have much to do, and to do it right will take time. How much better your speech will be and how much better you'll feel if you have taken the time to do it right. When you are prepared, you have gathered the needed data, determined what is appropriate to the listener's understanding and acceptance levels, organized the ideas so they flow logically, selected examples and other supports to your ideas, and made them interesting to your listeners. Developed a great opening that you know will capture the attention of even the daydreamers in your audience. Checked out the room where you'll be speaking, and requested any feasible changes you wish in the setup of the room. If you are prepared, you are confident that you can best convey your message to your listeners. If you've waited until a few days before your presentation to begin to prepare, or, worse yet, the day before, no doubt you'll be anxious, and with good reason. And now there is not enough time to engage in more than a superficial attempt. Both you and the audience will feel uncomfortable. Like retirement planning, it is never too early to start preparing for your presentation. So, start preparing right away.
You now have 40 seconds to check your answers to questions 17 to 20. That is the end of Part C. You now have 5 minutes to transfer all your answers from your test booklet to Answer Sheet 1.
Kimmy,